Tonight, the theme is François Laruelle, or The Secret. Let's begin with, in fact, going back to the first night, back to the concept of plastic reading, described in some of Catherine Malibu's recent writings, in particular this book I mentioned called Plasticity at the Dusk of Writing. Malibu tells a story in this book. It is a story about the end of writing, or rather the evening, the dusk, the winter of writing. There is what she says a historical tendency. So her thinking is following a historical tendency, proving again her good Hegelianism. And by this, she means that our particular mode of being is one that is necessarily predicated on history and historical change. Or maybe, perhaps to use the phrase of Frederick Jameson from a recent book, we cannot not periodize. In Malibu's historical periodization, we have arrived today at the end of writing. For Malibu, writing refers to the graphic, to the sign, to inscription, to the trace, all those kinds of mediation that have to do with fixity. And what's interesting is that she includes everything up through structuralism and even including much more recent developments. She mentions linguistics, but also genetics and cybernetics. So she's willing to include these more recent technological innovations under the heading of writing. So genetics is still writing in Malibu's view. She does not privilege something like literature. She doesn't even privilege writing on paper, for that matter. But at some point in the second half of the 20th century, the fixity of writing began to give way to change, or as we know now in her parlance, plasticity. This is a quote. Today we must acknowledge that the power of the linguistic graphic scheme is diminishing, and that it has entered a twilight for some time already. It now seems that plasticity is slowly but surely establishing itself as the paradigmatic figure of organization in general. This is quite a dramatic claim to make, I think. Fixity has given away to flux. This is essentially what she's arguing. Nothing can ever be written anymore, for we are living today in an endless era of fungibility. So this sense of plasticity also produces its own form of reading, which she calls plastic reading. Plastic reading, she admits, is a kind of structural approach. And you remember from the other night, I said that she's kind of an unrepentant structuralist. Kind of structural approach that aims to document what she calls the structure of philosophy that remains after a text has been subjected to certain analyses. So Malibu's structures, they're not essential in the sense of existing prior to the appearance of the systems that they describe. They only appear at the end, something like a kind of a husk that remains afterward. So I'll quote here. By structure of philosophy, I mean the form of philosophy after its destruction and deconstruction. This means that structure is not a starting point here, but rather an outcome. So structure is the thing that remains. It is not, as she says, a truth or a skeleton, but a trace or a fossil. Structure is not a starting point, but an outcome. It is an after, a result. Plastic reading is thus the reading that comes after deconstruction. And she means this quite literally. She means that it comes after deconstruction in the sense of, that it has come historically after the decades in which Derrida, et cetera, was active. But it also comes after deconstruction in the sense that one must first apply the methodology of deconstruction to a text in order to see the resulting plastic characteristics. The kind of blank experience itself of change, or you might even say the thing that doesn't change, even through change, that is what the plastic reading is all about. So I'll cite a longer section from an essay by Malibu on structuralism, which I also mentioned. The title is Generation After. To read, to comprehend a text, can certainly consist, even today, in withdrawing from it a structural kernel. But we know henceforth that this structure is not original. It emerges from the text as a result, the result of its own deconstruction. The structure names that which, in a text, survives its own deconstruction. This regenerative power of reading is precisely what I label its plasticity. So to Malibu, plastic reading is neither traditional, right, looking at the kind of straightforward meaning of the text, nor is it deconstructive entirely. It is neither reactionary nor destructive. In a sense, it is somewhat agnostic to these larger analytical forces. You can think of it maybe in the following way. Once the dust clears, and it becomes clear that the text has changed, or been changed, Malibu simply enters the fray and documents the change. And this change is the text in its plasticity. So we can say there's almost a kind of clinical quality to Malibu's approach to reading. She does not wish to intervene in a text, neither does she wish to read it straight. There will be those who do critique, there will be those who do not. Malibu merely seeks to be a witness to this event and reconstruct the metamorphosis taking place beyond it all. So I begin with a return to Malibu because I think her image of plastic reading is surprisingly similar to the general methodology espoused in the work of François Laruelle. Laruelle's project is extremely idiosyncratic and notoriously hard to get a handle on. Thus, while they otherwise have little in common, I hope that this description of plastic reading in Malibu might, as it were, soften our entree into the work of Laruelle. So when Malibu evokes in the previous quote, the form of the system without its presence, the form of the dialectic without its metaphysical understanding, one could easily mistake her for Laruelle. The form of the system without its presence, the form of the dialectic without its metaphysical understanding. So as I said the other night, Stiegler, Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari understood the significance of Laruelle's project before many, many other people did. François Laruelle, they write, is engaging in one of the most interesting undertakings of contemporary philosophy. That's from the book, What is Philosophy? He invokes a one-all that he qualifies as non-philosophical and oddly as scientific, on which the philosophical decision takes root. This one-all seems to be close to Spinoza. Born in 1937 and former professor at the University of Paris 10 at Nanterre, François Laruelle has elaborated over many years this project under the heading of non-philosophy. So maybe we can open this investigation into Laruelle and non-philosophy by looking at some detail at the essay that was circulated called The Truth According to Hermes, Theorems on the Secret and Communication, which was first published in French in 1987. And I'll just read a paragraph from my introduction to the translation. While the present essay does not address non-philosophy directly, and thus stands nicely on its own, nevertheless, important traces are evident of Laruelle's general approach. In particular, one might reference Laruelle's interest in radical immanence, evident here in his evocation of a pure Hermes, that is, a Hermes unsullied by the sallies and wanderings of hermeneutics. Laruelle's Hermes is a non-Hermes, one who touches the truth as such without any threat of deceit in exchange, without any metaphysical depth, and without the fog of semantic transfer. Laruelle's goal is to cut through the correlationist thinking associated with hermeneutics that forever breaks truth in half as truth and its communication, or the secret and its manifestation. We must instead, as Laruelle writes here, let the philosophers in on the secret so that they may pursue a rigorous science of truth. And this is a quote from the first thesis of the text. The unitary or dominant way of thinking is that of a generalized hermeneutics. This is how he opens the piece. But what is a generalized hermeneutics? It is an indissoluble correlation, he claims. And you should definitely be hearing here echoes of yesterday's discussion of correlationism in Meissu. It is, quote, the undecidable coupling of truth and its communication. Truth, argues Laruelle, never simply stands on its own. It always exists in a relationship of givenness vis-a-vis a human agent. And I guess I should qualify this and say this is Laruelle's reading of sort of the other side, right? So Laruelle would say that truth can stand on its own. This relationship of givenness is one in which truth is always given over to being and to being something available to the consumption of man. It matters little if that truth is hidden or revealed. What matters is that it is always already given over in advance to the possibility of being hidden or revealed. So the secret is really a kind of decoy, I think, for Laruelle, because he wants to not make the debate around whether something is hidden or revealed. So, in a similar way to Meissu's theory of correlationism, Laruelle describes here a scenario in which truth as such is only ever given over to a receptive perceiver. Thus, if we were to extract something like a correlationist principle from Laruelle, or to summarize it maybe in a nice little citation, I think it would be something like what he says in Thesis 16. I'm just going by the numbered paragraphs here. The real is communicational. The communicational is real. So that would be the Laruelle's version of the correlationist principle. This is the classical model which has been given over to us. And it's given over to us as Hermes. Hermes, of course, as the god of, among many other things, transport into and out of foreign places. So that's why the correlationist, you know, Hermes is sort of the most emblematic correlationist. We could maybe say that. This correlation runs quite deep. It is evident in metaphysical models. It is evident in how we think about interpretation and communication. It structures the basic relationship between, to use the terminology from Heidegger, being and Dasein, or being there, the uniquely human mode of being. Hermes is the patron saint of this kind of scenario, a scenario in which something far away must be given over to something close at hand, which becomes attentive to it. Hermes is the chaperone of travelers in foreign lands. He's the god of markets and merchants. Why? Because they, and also their goods, right, must travel abroad, just like a traveler does. Hermes sits at the door hinge, and one of his epithets is Hermes of the turning door. He sits at the door hinge because he is the god of thresholds. And, as you know, he gives his name to the art of literary interpretation, hermeneutics, for he is the god of translating what is obscure into what is known. But, to Laruelle, this is all merely a picture of that unitary and authoritarian Hermes. This Hermes must be replaced by a non-philosophical one. A Hermes who does not take the correlationist bait. Thus, Laruelle's Hermes, quote, defines the essence of truth as a secret, but as a secret that, in order to exist and to be made known, needs none of the light of the logos, none of the tricks of meaning, the strategies of interpretation, the horizons of the world, or the transcendent forms of appearance. This is all from Thesis 4. Truth as secret exists autonomously prior to the horizontality of appearance. The secret enjoys an absolute precedence over interpretation. It is itself the uninterpretable. So we might say that Laruelle's Hermes is an exclusively transcendental one. An exclusively transcendental one. Alienation, translation, interpretation, withdrawal, reflection, these many vectors of the human mind are all steadfastly resisted by Laruelle. In our vanity, we consider reason and logic to act in this way because we act in this way, or at least we think we do. But Laruelle is resolutely against such a narcissistic we. And we could maybe say that his is an extremely strong anti-phenomenology for this reason. That is to say, his is the rejection of any scenario in which a world or a thing is revealed to a solicitous subject. So that would be the anti-phenomenology, to reject any scenario in which a world or a thing is revealed or given to a solicitous or attentive, absorbed subject. So if Mayasu opposes himself to correlationism in the hope of arriving at absolute reality of some kind, Laruelle opposes himself to correlationism in the hope of arriving at absolute reason. In any case, both philosophers wish to remove the human perceiver from the equation as much as possible, I would say. What remains is, for Laruelle, is pure essence, transcendental immanence. And I'll read from paragraph 5. The secret is the strictly unreflected upon form of truth that, given to itself, gives nothing of itself and receives nothing of itself except the modality in which it is given. So it's a very aggressive confrontation with the Heideggerian phenomenological language, using the word give and given, but making it kind of exclusively self-contained. This condition is called the one by Laruelle, or alternatively, the in division, or the without division, or the non-interpretable. And there are a lot of other synonyms in the rest of his work that we can connect with this idea of the one. But what's interesting is that this one is not infinite. And this may be a point of difference with Meisu. This one is not infinite. It is not God or the absolute. Entities in their transcendental immanence are still simply entities. Hence, Laruelle labels these entities finite rather than infinite. They are finite in their immanent oneness. And this is another quote from Thesis 6. The secret is truth when it no longer needs to go out of itself and be for itself, when it is itself by staying in itself. And as I might mention again in a second, the word exist is kind of the enemy to Laruelle, and he etymologically he inverts it. He changes, so exist is sort of to be out of, ex ist. So he takes the ex and changes it from out to in, so from ex to in, and he changes the ist to this idea of immanence, one, and the result is in one, a hyphenated word, in one, which is what he, so he goes from exist to in one. So granted, in this essay, the terminology can be quite tricky because he's playing on these very similar words, like hermeneutics and hermetics. However, I think it does cohere at some level. We might say in general that Laruelle's is a Hermes as science, not a Hermes as art. So the old hermeneuts that he doesn't like are kind of like astronauts, right, or argonauts. These are the people who travel with Hermes at their elbow to some kind of foreign place. And recall in the piece how Laruelle dismissively calls philosophers the mere mailmen of truth. But Laruelle subtracts the individual from the equation, reaching directly through this mediating individual, this mailman, to touch Hermes himself. The secret, quote, never reaches a consciousness or vanishes when it does. So in this way, a hermetics, which is a positive term for Laruelle, a hermetics is the direct science of Hermes, not the science of the person traveling with Hermes. Removing the extra fluff of human mediation is part of what it means to do non-philosophy for Laruelle. Non-philosophy means essentially to select an existing philosophical system, hermeneutics say, and to analyze it exclusively for the abstract transcendental logics that exist within it. These logics are what remain once the human, the person who decides to do philosophy, is removed. Thus, even hermeneutics has a non-philosophical core, even if that seems contradictory, because hermeneutics is, you might say, you know, by definition about a relationship between self and other. Or nevertheless, even hermeneutics has a non-philosophical core, for it must propose something like an absolute or finite experience of truth, if it ever is able to meditate on the intractable difficulties of getting at such a truth, right? That's how Laruelle, that's part of his method. Right, so even if it adamantly refuses that such a truth is graspable, it has proposed that as a possibility, if only in a kind of silhouette or an outline. The non-philosopher then enters the scene, removes the human decision to reflect, and rescues the logic of the situation that remains. If truth is the scene, as it is in this essay, and the communication of truth is removed, then what is rescued is the transcendental immanence of a secret truth that has been revealed to no living person. So if a tree falls in the forest when no one is around, does it make a sound? Well, for Laruelle, all trees only ever fall in forests where no one is around, and they always make a sound. So let me pull back a little bit to explain how this essay on Hermes intersects with some of the larger concepts in Laruelle. And this is where the diagrams might be a little bit helpful, or might not. So non-philosophy hinges on a rejection of what Laruelle calls the philosophical decision. So what is the philosophical decision? To engage in the philosophical decision is to endorse the position that anything and everything is a candidate for philosophical reflection. Thus, to do philosophy means to reflect on things, to reflect on the world. And likewise, if one is being philosophical, one is necessarily being reflective, or we could maybe even say being kind of meta-philosophical. This is Laruelle's position. Non-philosophy means simply to refuse to engage in such a decision. In other words, non-philosophy quite literally refuses to reflect on things. Instead, non-philosophy withdraws from the decision to reflect on things, and in doing so, enters into a space of what Laruelle calls theory, or science. He uses both of those terms. So, it is tricky. So he says, where are you when you're doing this theory or this science? You're not reflecting on philosophy, you are alongside it. And from this place alongside philosophy, non-philosophy is able to take philosophy as its raw material, extracting from it various kinds of what he calls pure, non-reflected, autonomous, and radically immanent logics. So I'll quote from John Malarkey, who's written on Laruelle. Laruelle is abstaining from philosophy as such, while simultaneously taking it as its own raw material. So we might say that the goal of non-philosophy is a rigorous theoretical or scientific knowledge of philosophy. And even the word of becomes problematic for Laruelle because it just even within language, it proposes a kind of relationship between things, right? A of B or something. So he often will put the word of in parentheses because he's so worried about it. So he wants to maintain a notion of non-philosophy that does not reflect back on itself. And it doesn't actually even reflect on philosophy. It has maybe some kind of relationship to it, but it's not one of reflection. And this is his way of maintaining a kind of non-circularity. And he would defend the idea that there's nothing at all meta about non-philosophy. Instead, it is actually, maybe for the first time, doing real axiomatic or scientific work, he would say. So the subtext here is that Laruelle essentially considers philosophy to be a narcissistic enterprise, in that it turns the real world back on itself into the shape of something that can be looked at, reflected upon, absorbed in, and given over to man so man can be solicitous to it. Laruelle hates things like dialectics, causality, at least in the way that we normally think about it. He hates things like representation. But, of course, it is clearly the phenomenological scenario that he hates the most, and that he most closely associates with the practice of doing philosophy. Right? The world is given to us so we can think about it. Thus, instead of a notion of ontology as the relationship between being and existing, which we saw was endorsed by Malibu despite her positing of plasticity as the new kind of super concept, Laruelle speaks of the one as the real that is radically autonomous. So the one and the real are the same in Laruelle. And the one and the in one are the same too. Malibu's baseline morphability of being is therefore anathema to Laruelle, who would cast off Malibu as nothing more than the same old philosophical tricks. There is no low-level convertibility for Laruelle between the one and being, or something like that. The one is the non-convertible, the non-morphable. The one has no relationship to anything else. He rejects anything having to do with reciprocity, reversibility, or exchange. Therefore, normal notions of causality must be totally abandoned. Why? Because they always imply a causality of two directions. Even if it's a frustrated bidirectionality. So, causality as action-reaction, as a kind of dialectical contradiction, or other ways that we could conceive of causality. It's that bidirectionality that Laruelle doesn't like at all. Instead, Laruelle's theory of causality is a strong unidirectional causality, for which he borrows it from Marx. He borrows this label, determination in the last instance, which for him is one phrase, determination in the last instance, DLI. And here the diagram might be helpful. So that's his replacement for philosophical causality, is the determination in the last instance. The only causality proper to the one is a unidirectional and rigorously irreversible causality. Causality is therefore given a totally new name in Laruelle. It is called cloning. Why? Because cloning is a kind of logic that produces a dual entity through an identical copy. But the clone parent and the clone child never need establish a relationship with each other, and hence nothing is produced or synthesized during the act of cloning. Right? So he likes this idea of cloning because it's a way for him to talk about this act of maybe kind of identical copying without talking about synthesis. Right? So he doesn't throw out identity, but he throws out any notion of identity through synthesis. And also identity through reversibility. Right? Like, I am the child because I'm the child of you. He thinks of a kind of a parent that is absolutely unknowing of any progeny, to use that terminology. Okay, so the clone is thus, quote, a duality, which is an identity but an identity which is not a synthesis. And the word dual is okay for Larwell, but he throws out words like pair or binarism. But he thinks dual is okay because for some reason that's a way to think about kind of two-ness without relationship. So this also helps perhaps understand why Larwell's one is not at all metaphysical in nature, even though on both of these diagrams you see that there's a kind of something that might resemble a metaphysical relationship. The one is absolutely foreclosed to the clone. The clone can never, ever go back in the other direction. Yet the clone, as copy, is entirely dependent on the one. And that's the weird logic. So entirely dependent, just in the same way that a clone or a copy is a identical, has a relationship of identity. But access to the one is totally foreclosed. So the one exerts total determination over the clone, right? In this unidirectional way, and that's why he uses this word determination in the last instance. And the Marxian reference is essentially, you know, why does phenomena X happen? Well, there could be all these, you know, influences, but no matter what, in the last instance, it's always, you know, the mode of production that will have the final determining. So in Larwell's non-Marxification of Marx, he extracts that logic and uses it for his own project. Okay, so the one exerts total determination over the clone, yet at the same time is absolutely ignorant of the clone, and therefore is in a non-relationship with it. And this is what Larwell calls unilateral duality. And that's one of the diagrams. Unilateral, because it's one direction only. Duality, because it's not a pair, but there is a dual. It's unilateral, again, because the one is a kind of absolute, but never has a relationship with anything else, and hence only ever operates unilaterally, right? If we could never say the one has a bilateral or multilateral relationship. He also will never say that the one is merely kind of like on one side and is pitted against something that's on another side. There are no sides. So it's unilateral, but it's also a duality because the clone is a dual of the one, running, as he says, alongside it or according to it. So the only kind of like metaphysical-like terminology he'll ever allow are things like alongside or according to. But nothing like the, you know, instance of or representation of or form of. All those things have to go out. So Larwell's duality is thus never a two or a pair or a binarism or an opposition. Because binarisms only exist between like categories, between equals. The one is not equal to anything. There can be no parity with it. There can be only the duality of a clone. Right? The one is not equal to anything. Otherwise, it would not be the one. Given the flexible utility of Larwell's non-philosophical method, we can say kind of in closing here, maybe a little bit about, you know, what he's been up to over the years. He's had a long career and written many, many books, even though his first book has yet to be translated, or I think it's just coming out now, maybe. Given this kind of method of non-philosophy that for him is a kind of tool that's relatively flexible that can be moved around to any domain, he has engaged broadly across the spectrum of philosophical thought and has written books on a number of different figures. And predictably, he kind of replaces the existing discourses with their non-discourses. So we see strewn across Larwell's career a non-Marx Anon Deleuze, Anon Derrida, etc. So just to end the remarks on Laruelle, and then I'll say just a few closing things about the whole 5 days that we've done. I'll just read a quotation from John Malarkey's book, Postcontinental Philosophy, which just, I think, summarizes the Laruellian project quite well. Non-philosophy is not just a theory, but a practice. It rewrites or redescribes particular philosophies, but in a non-transcendental form. Non-aesthetics, non-Spinozism, non-Deleuzianism, and so on. It takes philosophical concepts and subtracts any transcendence from them in order to see them not as representations, but as parts of the real, or as alongside the real. Okay, so I want to just finish with maybe in the spirit of some kind of culminating remarks about the last 5 days. You know, I don't think that we have to assume that there's any kind of agreement between these figures. And in many ways, they are all extremely different. So Catherine Malabou, Bernard Stiegler, Mehdi Belesh Qasim, Quentin Meyassou, and François Laruelle. And perhaps it is true that they are characterized more by what they do not have in common, by essentially not being part of a unified school of thought, right? Like we can't talk about this as a unified school in the same way that maybe we could have talked about, you know, post-structuralism in 1970 or something. But if we were to make some kind of summarizing observations, maybe this is what we would say. In general, I think this week we've seen a number of things that one or more of these figures are against, and a number of things that one or more of these figures are as it were, for. So there does seem to be a trend against representation and for presentation, as we saw in the day on Belesh Qasim, or for the real, as we've seen with a number of figures. And this is connected, I think, with the desire to remove the human observer from the equation. Or to be technical, maybe we would say a certain kind of human perceiver. Maybe to give allowance for the whatever singularity. I think the non-philosopher would also fit in this trend to try to remove a certain kind of human perceiver. So there also seems to be a kind of backlash against phenomenology, although, of course, Stiegler would be the exception here, against the subject, against the anthropocentrism of the subject, right? And related to this, I think we can say that there's also a kind of backlash against hermeneutics. And the example here would be the clinical scientificity of non-philosophy, the plastic reading I mentioned, or in a different way, maybe realist speculations. What can we say there for our sort of being proposed, or what are some of these figures, as it were, for? I would say that there is a renewed interest in truth as such. I would say, interestingly, in I think almost every figure, a focus on nihilism. A focus on the concept of nothing. Sometimes that comes as the void or as chaos. And in a number of these figures, we also have something like realism. And a framing of the current debate as one between realism and Kantianism. So, you know, one of the contributions I've tried to make this week is that perhaps that is not the real debate, and that the real debate, this last point about the debate between realism and Kantianism, that maybe the real debate is really between realism and materialism. In other words, are you on the side of the real, or are you on the side of history?